what happens when bankruptcy beckons. Today on Sound Advice Entrepreneurs Unfiltered, we meet Frankie Thorogood, the CEO and co-founder of Potted, the crafty clay kit brand on a mission to help boost your mental health and feed your creativity. But before he started this venture, he created the sportswear brand TCA, starting out with just 100 quid. His wares were sported by professional boxers and MMA fighters. It became a multi-million pound brand, but things nearly went very differently for Frankie when he lost control of the cash. Today, we'll hear how he came back from the brink of bankruptcy and the lessons he learned from facing every founder's ultimate financial fear. Welcome, Frankie.
Hello, thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you on the show. So tell me, you're a serial founder, but you'll have to cast your mind back to the previous venture. So your TCA days, it all started with a football snood. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, it was. I think it was one of the coldest winters on record in the UK, and footballers started wearing snoods. So I went out to try and buy one for myself to wear at Sunday League, and I realized you couldn't actually buy them anywhere. JD Sports, Sports Direct didn't stock them. And that was when I got the seed of the idea that, well, you know, there's other people as well as me that want to buy them and no one's selling them. So let's maybe give it a go.
So you had your finger on the pulse. You managed to source them yourself, presumably, and perhaps started selling them before anyone else had cottoned onto the idea?
Yeah, I'm sure I was the first person in this country definitely to be selling them. I still don't know to this day where the footballers were getting them. They must have had some overseas supply. But I was the first one to start selling snoods, and that business turned out to be obviously a bit of a craze. So it came and went quite quickly, but it's what got my foot in the door in business to start with. And then obviously that kind of gradually became a sportswear brand.
Because you got into all different kinds of apparel. You had loads of different SKUs. So how did you go from like the one hero flash in a pan product to actually having a range that people, you know, wanted to own the whole thing of?
Well, I think, you know, it was pretty obvious to me that snoods were going to be a fad and a craze and it wasn't going to last forever. And in fact, what did eventually happen was the Football Association banned them. So footballers had to stop wearing them, which ironically turned into a huge day for sales because it hit the news. But the writing was on the wall for snoods, you know, from the start. So I kind of knew that wasn't going to be a sustainable business. So I, as a person that loves doing sports and I was playing football all the time, I just kind of was aware, I could see, basically see footballers have started to wear something underneath their jerseys, which was a new thing. So when they would exchange shirts at the end of the game, they were wearing something underneath it. And it turned out that this was coinciding with the time of the rise of Under Armour in the US. And so I realized that if the footballers were wearing these compression tops, maybe that was something I could look into. I hadn't noticed any people, you know, in Sunday League wearing it, or kind of like amateur sports people. So that's where the next idea came from. And I thought, let me investigate compression wear, the benefits, and maybe I can kind of go there. And that's how, that was the next step. And then compression wear turned into one of our, you know, core product lines at TCA. And yeah, they still sell, you know, the compression stuff that I developed back then to this day.
So you build this sustainable brand, your gear is being rocked by these athletes, and you've got a big name out there. So tell me, how did it nearly all come crumbling down? What was your flirtation with bankruptcy?
Well, I think to simplify it, I didn't understand the concept of cash flow. And to be honest, it's still something I'm not that great with. But I basically had no idea. This business was growing really fast. And whatever we developed and launched was selling, customers loved it. And I just hadn't wrapped my head around this idea that of cash flow. I literally didn't understand the concept. So when things are going really well, I was like, okay, let's expand the range. Let's launch 20 or 30 new products this year instead of the 5 that we've been doing, because clearly there's demand for what we're producing. So we did, we developed about 30 new styles. And this was in the Q4 of 2017 when we were due to launch them. And they were great products, carefully developed with the team. And like, you know, so we were pretty happy with them. But the problem was I hadn't like understood the concept that I would need to pay the suppliers back before I'd had time to sell the stock. Honestly, it's so simple. It's embarrassing to admit now, but that I'd managed to get this business to millions of pounds of revenue without coming up against this problem. And all of a sudden, I wanted to supercharge the growth, launch all these products all at one time without any finance in place whatsoever. This was just running off the sales cash flow of business. And of course it didn't work. And it got to the point where I was like, hang on a minute, I owe my suppliers all this money for stock that we've received, but I haven't had anywhere near enough time to sell it. So it's pretty much as simple as that. And that's how we ended up in that mess.
Can you remember the day or where you were or like how it all came unraveling? Did you suddenly speak to your accountant, your FD, or did you open a banking app? What was the moment that hit you and you were like, what am I going to do?
Well, you know, the thing is, it comes on a little bit slowly. There's one supplier set, you know, invoice due. And I'm like, oh God, like that's a bit of a stretch. Like we can pay it, but the bank account's looking a little bit empty. And then the next one comes in and you're kind of then scraping the bottom of the barrel. And eventually it dawned on me that this was a problem. And at that time, there was basically no financial control in the business at all. And it's just because it's not something that I'm interested in or good at, I'm good at the other stuff, I just hadn't bothered to think about it enough. So it wasn't a single day, but it just slowly crept up on me. And I was realizing that we weren't being able to pay these people back and the stock wasn't selling fast enough. So it was at that point I started to reach out and I spoke to my accountant. At that point, the accountants had really just been doing the kind of compliance work, like paperwork and submitting tax returns and stuff. They weren't actually overseeing the finances of the business and making sure something like this didn't happen. And I think, to be honest, like it's maybe a lesson for people listening is that, at least for me, like I kind of thought like my accountants, although they were being paid, you know, weren't being paid much, they were essentially just doing, like I say, the compliance. I kind of had this idea in the back of my head that maybe they would know, or maybe they would warn me if something was going wrong, but they weren't paid to do that and they weren't doing it. So that was, you know, that was a huge kind of oversight again by me. And I think like maybe I was just sort of like wishful thinking, like I'm sure it'll be fine, the accountants might be on it. They weren't on it. I was lucky to have a really great you know, accountant that I was working with, and I went to her and I said, I think I'm in a bit of trouble. What can we do about it? And she was one of the people that really helped dig me out of the mess.
So how big a hole were you in? How much did you owe?
I think it's about 300,000 is what we ended up in a hole. And so a huge amount. And the problem is, once you need that money desperately, people don't want to give it to you. Because you're not like a really, you know, particularly like attractive borrower at that stage. Even though we had a really healthy business, we had like products that would, you know, perennial sellers that even to this day are the top sellers on Amazon. We had that, you know, we knew that we had a good business. Banks just don't want to dish out money quickly and to kind of like, you know, fill that type of, you know, that type of hole that we had. So yeah, it was about 300 grand. And I think we'll come on maybe to the solution shortly, but it cost us a lot of money to kind of unravel that in the end.
I often hear this from entrepreneurs where it's like, the bankers only want to give you an umbrella when the sun is shining. When it starts to rain, that umbrella, there's no sign.
Get your umbrellas early.
Get your umbrellas early. Yeah, that should be the motto on every founder's t-shirt. So what did you do? How did you raise that kind of capital at very short notice? And also, how did you handle those conversations with your suppliers who were presumably left waiting for their money?
Yeah, I mean, so there's quite a few things that go into it. I mean, the first thing is, we had great relationship with suppliers, and I used to visit them, which I found out since is a little bit unusual, especially for people mainly operating in the Amazon space. But I met my suppliers in 2012, and the company still worked with them to this day. So we built up good relationship with them. I used to go and visit them at least once a year, usually two or three times out in China. So we had reasonable terms, although they weren't good enough to allow for the mess that we were in. But, you know, we also had like a good working relationship, a personal relationship with those guys. So, you know, some of them, we were trusted, you know, customer of theirs. They were kind of happy to just hang on a bit and trust us. And so that kind of bought us a bit of time. You know, there were so many people involved that helped get me out of that. You know, I mentioned my accountant, Debbie. She then introduced me to Gary, who became the finance director of TCA. And then Chris, who had recently hired as my COO, were kind of like three of the main characters that really, you know, helped me to understand what was going on and dig me out. So they were kind of like helping me work out, you know, actually put together a cash flow spreadsheet for the first time and work out what that all looks like. Then I spoke to every single bank under the sun to try and get some funding. I borrowed money off of all of my parents, all four of them. I borrowed money from the bank, pretended that I wanted to buy a car. So they gave me a loan for a car that obviously went straight to China for some some invoices that were owed. So I begged, borrow and didn't steal, but I probably would have if you pushed me, just to try and raise cash, you know, any which way I can. And so that was kind of how we did it. And then, you know, that wasn't enough. The bank wasn't going to move that fast to give us the trade finance that we needed, although they ultimately did, which we really, you know, needed to continue to grow the business anyway. But we ended up selling, I think I'm going to say £600,000 worth of stock for about £100,000. Yeah, so $500,000 just written off to try and dig out of this hole. And it took years, took 3 years to actually unravel the mess.
What, you just discounted so heavily to make sure people bought it just to get the turnover coming in?
Well, what was interesting was we realized, we learned quite a lot through this, aside from the basic things, but we did lower price and it didn't work that well. And that's one of the things that's actually influenced my thinking going forwards, is that what we realized is ultimately is that customers wanted to pay more for our products, not less, which is counterintuitive, but it was a very interesting lesson. So we did discount. Obviously, that was the first thought we had. Didn't really work. Like, people just, you know, thought, I don't know what they thought, to be honest, but price is an indicator of quality. And if you're too cheap, you know, you're going to put certainly some customers off. And our customers care about quality. So that was an interesting lesson. In the end, by the time we sold the business, we raised prices, you know, like every 3 or 4 months, slowly but surely. They were, you know, 50% higher than they had been before, and sales weren't dropping off. So we realized that we could actually sell our stuff for more money, which is another, you know, separate lesson. But the way we actually offloaded that stock was we found wholesale buyers who were looking for, you know, sportswear for actually physical retail stores, and they wanted to buy in bulk. And we built up a great relationship with a couple of them, and, you know, they got an amazing deal off us because they bought all of our stuff for, you know, some sort of crazy discount, but we had no choice.
Oh, that's really interesting. But that's better, right, than going direct to the consumer with crazy discounts, because then it's really hard to raise prices back to the previous levels, at least not in one jump. So that's clever. You go to a wholesaler and then, you know, people still feel like they've got a decent deal. They make their margin and you get some instant cash flow. Frankie, you say you have four parents. I have to go back. How do you have four parents? Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I think it might be beyond the scope of our conversation, but parents separated, new partners, all raised by all four. And, you know, most of all just came in handy when I needed money.
Hopefully they're not listening to this show. You only want us for our bank balance. No, I just had to ask.
No, it's fine. It's just, you know, like, I did borrow money from all of them, and quite, you know, significant amounts, which I didn't appreciate at the time, like how much they were kind of trusting me. Because I've now come full circle, and people have asked me, you know, to help them out in a situation. I'm like, are you kidding me? That's a huge amount of money, which I may never see again. The funny thing is, when we were doing all this, I was meeting with the banks and asking people for money. I was almost so ignorant and so naive of the depth of the problem that we were in, that I never lost faith and never lost confidence that it would all be fine. And it's almost like, you know, that kind of ignorance, I guess, ignorance was bliss. It just gave me that confidence to go to people and say, like, no, you will get your money back. It's a really good business. We just have a short-term problem. And I think ultimately that really helped, not only with the friends and family. The family would have probably given the money anyway and just wrote it off because they love me. But the banks, you know, the banks had to kind of take a little bit of a risk on me. And I think it did help, almost being so naive. But I paid back all my parents.
But talk to me a bit about your mindset then, because you've mentioned the positivity that you brought to the situation, which I think is amazing and we can expand on. But, like, what were your feelings when you realized that you'd spent all this time building this amazing business and this one mistake, this one kind of silly oversight threatened to completely unravel everything that you had made? What were your emotions? What was your emotional state like at this point? How did you have kind of feelings of terror, failure? How did you feel at this point?
You know, I really think I'm the type of person, and I think a lot of entrepreneurs that might be listening could relate to this, but I thrive on a crisis. You know, I love it. When I've got my back to the wall and the odds against me, it's, to be honest, is when I perform my best. It was time to meet, you know, I kind of thrived on the challenge, and I just said, like, it's time to knuckle down and go to work to solve this. And I just, you know, I really back myself in those type of situations where you know, everything's on the line. And I've just, like I say, just got to knuckle down and go to work and turn it around. And it's also the times when other people would be keen to write me off. It's probably, you know, my motivation more than anything is to try and disprove people. So, you know, that was kind of what the feelings were for me. You know, underneath that, I think if I'd had time to dwell and stew on it, it could start to become the less productive emotions of fear and just kind of like, ruminating on what, you know, because I'd put so many years into the business at that point, it could all be coming to nothing. I just think of my natural state is not to go down that negative route. And it's just to, like I say, come out swinging, try and solve the problem. So, that's kind of how it played out in my head, really.
And when you say back yourself, do you mean just having faith in your instincts and trusting that you will be able to work it out? What does back yourself mean?
I think I've got what they call in psychology an inner locus of control, which I think a lot of entrepreneurs probably need this to be successful, but that means that I feel that I am responsible for what happens to me, whether it is good or bad. And so I felt responsible for creating the mess that I was in, and I also felt that I was in control of being able to turn it around. So I think it's a natural, innate, you know, something I was either born with or developed early on. It's just that, you know, inner self-confidence. And I'm not like that with everything, but I do think whether I win or lose, I always feel like it was in my power to do so. And I think as a general rule, it's probably quite a good place to be. Although the flip side of that is you can start to think that you need to control everything or you need to do everything, and you start to struggle with things like delegation. And maybe sometimes things aren't directly down to you and they were good or bad, but you might take responsibility for it. So it's a double-edged sword, but that, I think the good side of it is what helped me out in this case.
That's really fascinating. And I think a lot of people listening will, as you say, they will identify with that feeling and that feeling of being an agent of their own destiny and being able to steer the ship one way or another. And you did steer this ship soundly in the end, and TCA became a multi-million pound brand on Amazon, where it can be extremely hard to stand out from competition, especially in something like sportswear, where I don't even want to imagine how many different shops and Amazon itself selling all these different types of sportswear. So how did you do it?
So I think the Amazon piece is quite interesting. And I did a presentation on this at an Amazon event last week, and it kind of forced me to like go back and investigate the story and what I had done a bit more. And I think the way I was able to be successful in Amazon, ironically, was to do pretty much the opposite of what every other single person who tries to be successful in Amazon will do. So, by way of example, I didn't turn up to Amazon thinking, I want to sell something and make money on Amazon. What my mission was to create a world-class sportswear brand that just happened to be selling on Amazon.
What does that mean?
Well, I think Amazon is a marketplace, right? That's what it's called. It's called a marketplace. And when you think about the term marketplace, imagine a marketplace in the real world that's not on the internet. What is a marketplace? It's basically somewhere where almost anyone can turn up and start selling whatever they want. And they tend to go towards lower quality products because of that reason, because anyone, there's a very low barrier to entry to turn up and sell in a marketplace. My instinct was everybody is shopping on Amazon, and they actually want to buy good products. They don't want the cheapest thing. And so if we can create, like I say, a world-class sportswear brand with incredible products that we spent months and months, sometimes years developing and designing, and we put that into the Amazon marketplace where everybody else is playing a price game and selling low-quality things, we might just clean up and we'll be the outstanding brand in that context. So that was kind of what turned out to be a bit of a USP with the business, was a focus on great products, focus on a great brand, and just taking that and putting it into a context where that was actually quite rare.
How do you communicate that on Amazon, though? Because like you're presented with this very sort of anodyne shop window, and it's very hard to stand out, right? Because ultimately, you have to just show a picture of what you're selling, and you've got limited space. So how do you communicate quality, especially if people are searching and, you know, you just see all these little icons, all these little different versions of things. So how did you do that?
Yeah, good question. I mean, it changed over time. So back in 2012, the Amazon Marketplace was very in its infancy, and you actually got very few tools to play with. So you had basically a product gallery and some bullet points and a title. So very constrained, but even within those variables, I was able to convey to the customer that they were buying a great product with a team behind it that had thought about what they were selling, and they weren't just churning out cheap rubbish. So it's small things, but, like, you know, my background's in marketing. Before I started TCA, I actually wanted to go into the advertising industry. And that's because I love working out how to communicate to customers, which is what advertising is to me. So it was tiny things. In the bullet points, it was a tone of voice and the copywriting, which I did all myself and I still do now, because I still think that that's something unique that I can bring to the table. So writing in the right tone of voice, you know, it would stand out from maybe a competitor that's just listing some features, you know, in a very direct and there's no kind of emotion behind it. One of the simple things I did was just naming the colors of the product. So we would have, like, let's say a compression top in the early days that was blue, red, black, and yellow. So I spent hours, probably too long in hindsight, thinking of what shade of blue that represented to me and what I would like to label it to a customer. So it would end up being, I can't remember it's a good example now, but there'll be like a cool name for a blue color, and there'll be a cool name for the red. So they weren't just these obvious primary color names. And customers, that speaks to customers. They understand that you know, you're working with a real design team and it's a kind of like a brand that's got some thought behind it. So even in the early days, 2012, when all you had was pictures, title, bullet points, we could still stand out. The product imagery, of course, spent like hours on just to make sure that the lighting was correct and we could show it off to its best ability. And it takes a little while because you might not be the cheapest product on there. But once you start to get a couple of sales and you get what we got, which was rave reviews because the product they got was so good, you can slowly but surely rise up the rankings. And that's how we did it.
And that's it. You can't fake reviews. Basically, you have to have a good product because otherwise you will get slaughtered in the reviews, and there's just nothing you can do about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, this is like, we're talking about Amazon specifically here, and it is more relevant. Like, reviews are your lifeblood of your business on Amazon. But if you start with a great product, you don't actually have to worry about getting good reviews because everybody likes what you're selling. And, you know, we never had to worry about it. We're always looking over our shoulders, worrying about negative reviews and whether our, you know, rating was going down to 4 or 3. It was never an issue because we knew the product was great. And so I say to people, like, starting business specifically on Amazon, don't fall into the trap of just finding something to sell. That isn't, to me, that's what running a business backwards. Don't turn up to marketplace and say, like, what can I sell? That's crazy. You need to work out what customers need that they don't currently have, and then put the work in to make a great product, and, you know, kind of the brand builds itself.
Yeah, we had a seller from Amazon. Her company is Gamely Games, and she said, I don't understand why people go with a Me Too product to Amazon. Then you're in a race to the bottom from day one. You need an original product so that no one else is selling what you are selling. And then you can choose your price point, and you build in enough of a kind of buffer there that Amazon can take what's theirs and you still have a decent margin. Otherwise, it's impossible. And that resonated with me. And that's clearly the path that you took as well.
Yeah, exactly. Like I say, it was I want to build a sportswear brand. There's this thing called Amazon, which makes it really easy to get your product in front of customers. So, you know, that's how I did it. And I just, with hindsight that I can see that was really the opposite of what almost everyone was doing on Amazon at the time. And to be honest, still to this day, you know, the question I get is like, how did you find what to sell? I'm just like, what are you on about? This is really not the way to run a business. I mean, to be honest, some people might be good at that. Maybe they can, like, and it's all gaming the system. But for me, it's make a great brand, make a great product, put it on Amazon because that's where the customers are.
So speaking of make a great brand, make a great product, your new business is Potted. So tell me where you got the inspiration for that. It's a massive step away from sportswear. So how on earth did you come up with the idea for this venture?
Lockdown. Lockdown was very, very helpful, actually, for me to get the headspace to prepare TCA for sale, just to kind of close that off, you know, because that's when we ended up selling. It was right in the heart of COVID. And it was actually quite you know, being able to work from home and just having a bit more space to myself and less interaction with the team really gave me the space to actually go and sell that business. And 18 months prior, that TCA was valued at less than £1,000 by a business broker. And you know, 18 months later, it was multi-million-pound exit. So COVID was quite helpful for me in the sense it gave me the time and space to think about that. And then, of course, it changed everyone's lifestyle. So myself included, a lot more time in the house. And unfortunately, what I found was I would fill that time with screens. And so it came to the point where me and my girlfriend were sat on the sofa, you know, this is after work hours, and we're both hunched over on separate sofas, scrolling our phones with the TV on in the background. And I just thought, like, this is not how I want to spend the rest of my life. This is not a good use of my time. And I felt, you know, I could feel the negative effects of my mental health. And I'm a creative person and I wanted to do something creative. So we decided like, we're not going to do this anymore. And we started to experiment with different types of craft products, because that was, like, you know, obviously a great thing to do in COVID at home. And we tried various bits and pieces. And the one we liked most was air drying clay. And, you know, basically that's where the idea came from. And I thought to myself, well, I know that TCA is going to be sold in a few months, because we were kind of on that process. And I thought, what am I going to do afterwards? I've heard a lot of stories about people that put their heart and soul into a business for years and they sell it and then they're just depressed afterwards. And I thought, I really don't want that to be me. So why don't I start a little side hustle with this, you know, air drying clay, and just, you know, that'll keep me busy once TCA has sold. So that's kind of how it got started. That was the inspiration. And like I say, it really just started as like a little bit of a hobby on the side, really started from scratch. You know, we're cutting up blocks of clay on the kitchen table, wrapping them up, posting things out. It was kind of like back to day one of TCA again. But that's how it all came about.
But did it very quickly mushroom from this tiny little side hustle type venture to being something that was a bit more, you know, had legs? And how quickly did that happen?
Yeah, so it did. I mean, we, you know, started off very small, like 50 units of this thing. And like I say, we're literally chopping clay ourselves. So it's kind of like labor intensive. But yeah, they sold well. And then, you know, it's literally like the same as the snood scanner. Right, that sold, let's order some more and sell some more. And it just kind of started ticking over and growing until it became obvious that there was at least a reasonable size business in this. TCA got sold. And to be honest with you, I wasn't actually feeling in need to run a new business as I predicted I would. I was quite happy to just spend time in the gym and just like relaxing and doing other stuff. But Potted kept going. And then probably like 6 months after, I was like, this is a really serious business now. There's an opportunity to do something special. So, you know, let's now start to invest the time in it and see what we can do.
But I noticed your approach with Potted is a bit different, because when I looked at the website, very simple, only one particular product for sale at the moment. Are you planning to sort of branch out, or are you going to keep it very simple, very pared back, concise?
So I think, you know, one of the issues, I guess, with TCA, which was the sheer number of products that we had. And that did kind of come up in the sale process. And it's like people saying, how do you manage so many? To us, it didn't seem like a big deal. But, it did make me think, okay, maybe it's better to have a bit of an 80-20 principle where, you know, we don't have to spread ourselves so thin over so many products. So Potted is great because we have the one kit, which is doing really well. I don't think one product makes a business, or you know, very rarely. You know, people's tastes might change. So anything could happen, really. One product's too much to be like pinning all your hopes on. So at the moment, we're developing other products in the space, which is kind of like a new space that we're defining as a creative activity space. And so I don't see any reason why we shouldn't expand the brand and expand into more products that kind of hit the same points, you know, for customers that Potter did. So it's about encouraging creativity and being good for your mental health, and ideally being able to share it with someone else, whether it's like a partner or friends. Yeah, at the moment it's the one product that's doing most of the work for us, but this year we're launching 3 or 4 more, like, what I think are like amazing other products in the similar space as well.
I love that you say share with a partner. I've got this vision of all these people across the nation with their ghost moment, with the Demi Moore and the Patrick Swayze having their potted kit. But you said that it was a hit with customers, but how are people finding you? Are these like fans of the TV program, The Great Pottery Throwdown? Has there been a big like clay pottery revival? Have you been kind of riding that wave?
It's a good question. To be honest, we've not taken a step back and looked at it on a really macro level, you know, like what you're kind of like talking about there. Like, is pottery or is air drying clay like a huge like wave at the moment? We've not actually looked at like that as in terms of a macro trend. You know, a lot of people kind of ask me like maybe this was a lockdown thing. It's not. People still want to do, you know, creative activities, as we call it now, when they, you know, they do have the option to go out. So I don't know on that level whether like there's a pottery revival, but I do think people are more conscious of mental health. They're more maybe cost conscious as well, and like potted is very affordable and like great value product. Like I say, you can do it with two or even four people with one kit, and it's kind of like hours of, you know, entertainment. So I think, you know, that doesn't really change. People want to be creative. They like to get into a flow state, which is like, you know, extremely easy when you're working with your hands. That's like a scientifically proven thing. Like working with your hands gets you into a flow state. People like that. Do more creative stuff and kind of bonding. So what me and my girlfriend found as well was it's just like you can sit there and it's actually different sitting shoulder to shoulder with someone as opposed to maybe opposite somebody, and you're working on your own thing together with your clay. And you can just start to like talk more and open up a little bit more. And it's this beautiful like bonding that happens. And it can happen with a friend as well, or, you know, family member. So I think all of that stuff is kind of timeless. And I don't think people will stop wanting that anytime soon. So again, that's why we got the confidence to launch these other products, which have nothing to do with clay, because they hit all those same, you know, those same kind of points.
Can you keep the same name? Can you still have everything under the potted brand, or are you going to have to do a radical change there?
Yeah, I'm we're keeping the name potted, and you know, when it's not a pottery product, it won't make sense, but I don't think it matters. And I don't think anyone really cares. And I basically at TCA, I remember I worked with a guy called Peter. He was actually the creative director of Under Armour at one point, and he came and worked with me on TCA. And I remember saying to him, oh, the brand name, like, it's just, I don't know whether we need to change it, or, you know, can really expand with this because it kind of doesn't mean what it used to mean. And he said to me, like, anything can be a brand. And I thought, oh my God, you're right. Look at Under Armour. I mean, Under Armour is probably one of the worst brand names ever, you know, invented. You know, Under Armour makes no sense on a pair of trainers. You know, it sounds like underarm. It's too long. People spell armor differently in different countries. There's just so many things wrong with it. And yet it's, you know, top three sportswear brand in the world. So I think it doesn't matter what the brand is called. I think this is what Jeff Bezos says, you know, your brand is what people say about you when you're not in the room. It doesn't matter what the name is. Amazon's a terrible brand name. It's about the value and the equity that you build up into through everything you do and your products and how you interact with customers.
What does TCA stand for, by the way?
Yeah, so I kind of regret bringing that up because that was a question I used to hate getting. So originally it was a total compression advanced because it was compression wear that we were doing. We changed the meaning of the name to thorough good competitive apparel. So it could be, you know, more broader than just the compression clothing. But, you know, ultimately TCA is the brand and that's what people know it as. And like I say, it kind of doesn't really matter. People know what the brand stands for in their minds and in their experience. So it turned out not to be a problem. And I think the same will be true for Pothead as well.
Do you still watch TCA like a hawk? Do you still go on Amazon, or do you still look out for how the brand is going down here and around the world? Is it possible to ever really let go when you've put so many years of your life into something?
Well, I did wonder, but for me, it actually came as a relief to be able to let go of TCA. And I think maybe it comes back to that kind of like inner locus of control, you know, like topic that we were talking about before. But I'm one of these people that I'm kind of 100% obsessed with something or I'm not. So it had come to the point with TCA where I actually had an urge to go and explore other things in life, hobbies and different types of products and brands I had ideas for. But I couldn't do it with TCA, you know, still under my control. I had to be all in on TCA. So it became a real relief to me to be able to relinquish it and have a clean break and say, you know what, I've done my part on this now and it's someone else's job to take the journey further. So from that perspective, it was a very, you know, a good thing for me to sell the business. And, you know, the team stayed on after the sale. So I knew it was in good hands. And I did get updates and I heard about things doing. They launched some amazing new products, which, you know, they wouldn't have done, I probably wouldn't have done. And they, you know, had a different leadership. So they went and did those. And in the kids, you know, kids sportswear, which I think is some really awesome stuff. So yeah, I was really happy with how they took it on. And the only bad news was that whenever I need new things, I actually have to go and buy it now, like a normal person.
What, you don't get a founder discount?
I think the founder discount ran out now. Literally have to go on Amazon and order things.
And that point about kind of moving on to new things. So you're still young. Like, is Potted your swan song venture? Is that going to take you to the end of your days? Or do you have like loads of other ideas that you're desperate to bring to market at some point?
Yeah, I think a lot of my ideas are around the creative activity space that we're doing with Potted. You know, that we talk about mental health a little bit and creativity, like those are two of my kind of like passions and I guess like my core values. So Potted, I can see being, you know, it is a very successful brand, but I also kind of would like to see an impact on, you know, another level as well. So for example, with Potted, we work with a charity called North London Cares, which is like helping like more older neighbors, you know, in the area who are kind of struggling for a social connection. And the charity brings those people together for activities and stuff. So I started volunteering at some of those. And I said, well, how about we do like a clay, you know, pottery night? And so we did, we donated all the kit and we went in and like taught these guys how to use it. And I think people had an amazing time and it was a real hit. So we're continuing to do that type of work with North London Cares. And I want to start working with some other mental health charities as well. So I'm excited about that for the future of Potted, is to make an impact outside of just the business, which, like, to be honest, is kind of strange thing for me to even say, like, it doesn't seem like me, but it's something I'm passionate about. So I think that's like driving me forward. And then no, I don't think, you know, Potted will be my last business. It might be my last physical product business for a while. I'm not sure. It's something I do know how to do, but I'd be keen to learn how to maybe do a different type of business model in the future. And I think I've got like personal projects that I want to work on, you know, like writing and other like creative pursuits. So they might turn into businesses as well, I'd imagine.
It's interesting how, as a leader, as an entrepreneur, as a human being, obviously we always evolve and our motivations change, our goals change. So it's good to kind of leave some space for that to happen. But Frankie, I have one more question for you, and I can't resist asking you this. I saw on your LinkedIn that the quote on your page is the best founder and CEO of all time. And there's like a list of the awards every year and then into your future, into perpetuity, the best founder and CEO of all time. Tell me about that.
I mean, I don't know if you spend a lot of time on LinkedIn, but it is full of garbage. It is just full of it. I haven't got time for that type of stuff. People really bigging themselves up, going on about how great they are. These awards. I mean, that joke about the best CEO was, I went on someone's profile who was trying to help me sell TCA at one point. And you know, his profile had like CEO of the Year award. I was thinking, who's giving out CEO of the Year? Like, and who are you? I've never heard of you. You're not CEO of the Year. You've got like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just ridiculous. So yeah, I just don't have time for that stuff on LinkedIn. So, you know, I think like, I just deal with the absurdity of existence by shoving absurdity down existence's throat, I guess.
I think that's an amazing place to stop, and what a quote to end on. Huge thanks to Frankie for joining us today. You can find him on LinkedIn. And you can also order one of his beautiful clay kits from pottedpeople.com. That's pottedpeople.com. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love if you could take a few seconds to hit subscribe on Spotify or iTunes or whichever platform you're on right now. I'm your host, Bex Byrne-Callender, and we'll be back next week with another incredible business story. So see you then.